This is the Agile Thoughts Podcast, and I'm Lance Kine.
This is Will Iverson with ChangeNode. Go check it out, changenode.com. And I've got a website there where I'm helping folks in the tech industry think about jobs and careers and how to move all that forward. And the YouTube video also covers tech and especially job stuff.
This is a continuing episode of a series with Will Iverson about tech jobs and IT in the face of AI. I hear that the overall message here, Will, is there's a big industry around putting AI everywhere, just like there was a big industry around putting websites into everything or putting all your business processes into self-help websites.
Yeah.
That's why we don't have, you don't go to the travel agent anymore to book a flight somewhere. You go to a website.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there was a period, and this is how you date yourself, because it's like, well, how many times do you go through these things where it's like,
you know,
I'm only going to use software that works with keyboard, with mouse and windowing. You know, just because I can run, you know, WordStar as a terminal app inside of Windows, that's actually not the point. I want it to actually be a proper graphical user interface. You know, the internet, and there's this old joke about every software adds features until it sends and receives email.
That's wow. Alrighty then.
That's an old Unix joke about how people just keep adding features, right? But yeah, like today, like if I said, yeah, I've got a piece of software and it should talk to something on the internet or whatever, like you just, of course. So yeah, AI and LLM stuff, what keeps happening is, and it's so weird because we're simultaneously grumpy, especially if we lose our job.
Absolutely. Right.
Right. Because like everybody comes into work and you're like, hey, I just lost my job, you know, but I also have this really killer ChatGPT subscription for $10 a month or whatever. It makes my life so much easier.
Right. And that person's somewhat suspicious now that the AI has taken its job, their job, I mean. And so that's another reason to be grumpy, but yet they kind of like it. So it's a pain in the ass, man. This is called cognitive dissonance, man. It's all over the place. And I feel like the title of the show should be, we start out with a dystopian gap. But I think you can dwell, or I'm going to take this in a different direction. Maybe you don't want to go this direction, and you'll just tell me. But we can all wallow and like, God damn it. You know, I was a woodcutter. I was chopping down trees left and right, making bank. And then the, you know, coal and all these other energy resources became a big deal. And now I'm pissed off. And I think the woodcutters who like, there's the ones who are close to retirement. They just kind of like retired. And there's the ones who are like kind of hungry. Like, you know, they probably got a lot of bills to pay. They got that expensive truck out front. They're going like, I got to find a new way to do this. They probably learned something, went somewhere in some other direction. So they pivoted somewhere. And I feel like we've just spent a whole bunch of time, Will, talking about why AI is not going to go away, why there's still a lot of work to do, because you just described several dissatisfactions that you can't use AI in a suitable way because, well, you know, we can't PowerPoint with it yet. I'm sure we can any day now. It'll probably drop. But so there's a lot of work. And then you were talking about the investors maybe are going to go with the AI rather than the 5,000 developers, which I think the 5,000 developers doing AI might be the ultimate solution. But because we also described or talked about how you can't really do software development without a software developer, whether you have AI or not. I think we've talked about that. We know that vibe coding's a thing. We know that like truck drivers in Canada have made apps, but are they sustainable and can they maintain them? And I predict not, but I also believe that it's a way to learn how to code is to do vibe coding, and it's kind of teaching you how to collect requirements. It's teaching you how to like work with it. So you're learning software development by trying to do vibe coding. So I think all roads are leading back to there's things to do in the world, but now it seems like if you want your income to stabilize or increase, it's got to have the label AI somewhere in it. If you try to double down and put the blinders on, you're more at risk at probably can still do software development, but the amount of money that you could have made maybe much less. Or
yeah, I mean, years ago now, you know, I would as part of my phone screen, I would ask people if they wrote tests, right? And at one point I would have said, you know, yeah, we do CI/CD, and that means that you're going to be writing tests. And there was a point when I would say to a developer, they would say something like, oh, I don't do that now, but I really want to learn. And I'd be like, cool, because that shows that you're interested and you're in want to invest in it. That drifted to eventually it got to where it was like, if somebody said, I've never done it before, or especially if they were like, no, I just don't think it makes sense, then cool, boom, instant round file on the resume. And I think we're at this really weird spot where having a nuanced, complete view of AI is going to be a big factor for getting jobs. Mm-hmm. And part of it is when the economics, the macroeconomic situation gets better, I do think that there's a lot of epic projects. That's the term I use for it. They're the big things that we actually all kind of need, right? We need cheaper universal healthcare, you know, whatever economic structure is used to support that. We need way more housing. We need the deployment of renewables for energy. We're going to have to, like, by way of example, just the petroleum industry, like even the big petroleum exporting company countries, they know that they're moving off oil. And there are millions of people in this country that rely on petroleum jobs from their economics. So we're going to have a lot of conversations about what do we really need to do and how are we going to pay for it? What's the economics look like that? The weirdest one, and this is the dystopian point, might be like, hey, we want to deploy healthcare for everybody. We want to feed everybody. We want to house everybody. But if we can't figure out how to pay for it, then everybody just sits at home and is sad. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some point where you're like, well, wait, how is this supposed to work?
That's tough. How is it supposed to work? And we've seen visions of that in different science fiction movies or scenarios. There's the... Oh my gosh, what's the Expanse, where the Earth has a UBI, but people are really, they're really not being effective, at least what the shots that you see about the people living out in their, on the streets, even with UBI, it's a big mess, it looks like. But that's, you know, well, I don't know if it has to be so that
the
way.
The Expanse, part of what holds the Expanse back as a show, and this is definitely getting into sci-fi, The Expanse wants to tell a story about class problems, right? And so they can't, there's stuff in The Expanse that makes no sense. Like all the Belters, where they're sitting out there on space stations and they're like poor underclass. And like, you think about that for about 5 seconds and you're like, no way. There's none of that makes any sense at all. The vision of UBI as sort of this dystopian nightmare versus, I mean, that's basically Star Trek's economy. Like, there's actually a whole books on Star Trek economy. And it's so wild to me because, like, if somebody's retired, you know, and they live on $200,000 a year of retirement, like, people don't go, oh, what a bunch of dystopian bums, even if they inherited it. Like, what's their use to society? You know, like, people don't talk like that. We've got multi-generational wealth that, you know, sits on top of huge amounts of money, and nobody speaks of them like that. I do think that our biggest problem is going to be our own biases about how we talk and think about this stuff, because we can't get our heads wrapped around it any other way. I mean, a UBI, like, you could pass a UBI. If I said everybody in the country gets $1,000 a month, right? Like, is that going to genuinely mean that people stop working?
Of course, like, not. There's people who think that, but...
Yeah. And we have all these studies. People are doing UBI studies right now where they show that's not the outcome. Instead, you get much healthier people. You actually see drug use drop. You see people go back getting better jobs because they feel more secure in their environment. I always think about, like, when you're really poor and, like, you can't even afford to keep your car going. Right? And it's like, I can't, like, you know, I lost my job because I couldn't afford to fix my car. Right? That kind of stuff, where it's like, there's actually a lot of material that show research that shows that if you are broke enough, it actually is this huge impediment towards living a decent life.
You need to have a
phone.
That's
the dystopian component of the dystopian gap. Mm. Because if you get enough people that are out of work, what are they going to do? Let's say
they're going to go lay down on the White House, lay down on the in Washington.
Yeah, so you might lie down. We saw, like, in Soviet Russia when things got sideways, that then you had this huge black market economy appear.
Mm.
Like, the most dystopian version is barter. There's documentary stuff about people in Detroit when Detroit collapses, where, like, there's this one movie documentary where it's this woman and she's just growing rabbits in her backyard. Right. And then she trades the rabbits for other things.
Uh-huh.
So the dystopian gap component is, I can see this vision of it where my personal take is that 5, 10, 15 years from now is actually probably going to be pretty awesome, because we're going to have access to all this tech and all this tooling. We can make cheap renewables. We can deploy it. We can start talking about environmental stuff. We can start talking about healthcare. We can start all this stuff. The problem is that we've got to get through these years where people are, like, in that mindset of, well, if you don't have a job, then you're, why do you even live? Almost that mindset.
Mm.
And it's going to be a hell of a thing. Like, how one way of thinking about it is, like, what is hitting bottom going to look like with technological unemployment before we actually do start thinking about that stuff? And because that's essentially inherently a political conversation, nobody really wants to talk about it. Right?
I don't know if nobody wants to talk about it, but it's really uncomfortable, even the imagining it. It's to be, I mean, that's another reason, mm-hmm. whether it's political or not.
Yeah. It is uncomfortable because it breaks everything about, and you know where this is hitting us right now? Is college. My kid's a teenager right now, so he's several years away from thinking about college, right? So here's the question I'll throw out. And this is, again, it's sort of like vaguely rhetorical. It's not something that you can just be like, boom, I've got the answer for. Out-of-state tuition or private tuition right now, it's like $50,000 a year. Okay?
That low? Out-of-state tuition? You're saying out-of-state. You mean in-state?
Yeah, so if I'm in Washington State and my kid goes to one of the UCs, right?
Yeah.
It's like $50,000 a year for tuition.
Oh, that doesn't okay. count. Got it. Yep.
It doesn't count room and board and books and all that.
Okay.
It's like that's, about $50,000.
That seems right. Yeah. That seems right.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the kick. Like, you know, what we've been telling kids for like at least a decade is you can just put it on a debt, put it on a card, right? Cool. You won't be able to get rid of it through bankruptcy or anything.
Right.
In the fine print. Right. What would you tell a kid to go to school for that they're going to feel economically viable with pick a figure, $200,000 in student debt?
Medical care. Sorry, that was my quick answer.
Yeah, medical, right? Maybe boomer retirement medical care.
Oh, that's true.
Like boomer medical care, right? So,
but that costs even more, though. That's like, well, it depends. But you could be a technician, not a doctor, right, for that kind, like, of school amount. But it costs, right, even more, I mean, for a doctor and all that.
Yeah. I mean, oh, good Lord. If you want to go be a doctor and it's like 10 years and $500,000. And
8 years, right? I don't know. I thought it was 8, but maybe it's 2 years before that.
Are you primary care? Are you a specialist and blah, 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 like all the things, right? But even the $200,000, if my kid said, hey, I want to go to school and I'm going to go become an English major and I'm going to put $200,000 in debt on.
Right.
Right. So the term for this is social contract, right? Like, as in, what is, if I do what society says, if society says I should go to college, right? And then I should be able to have a decent life, right? If my life goals are, I want to be able to buy a house, have kids someday, be comfortable, pay for my health care, pay for my stuff, right? Have savings, whatever, for retirement. What majors would you tell a kid to do? $200,000 minimum. Let's just use that as the baseline.
For you mean a salary?
No, for how much debt you're going to walk away with.
Okay. No, I mean, it can't be, unfortunately, it can't be like philosophy or liberal arts. Because, well, Because, I mean, it can be, but the problem is it's now all on your shoulders to figure out how you're going to self-employ yourself. Or maybe not self-employ, but employ yourself. If it's an engineering job, you probably will be all right. If it's a science, technology, engineering, math, like a math degree, I don't know. I'm not sure how... I don't know what math degree, what people get paid when they have math degrees, when they work for insurance companies or whatever, when they go into industry.
I have family that got a math degree and wound up being a teacher.
And that's not good. Maybe a professor, but not a teacher.
Nope. She teaches, I think, high school level.
Yeah. No, it's a problem. You can't, there is no... Society will constantly break that social contract. There's like a whole bunch of jobs that you can take that aren't going to work out well for you.
Yeah. So, and this is where like this is why I'm super fun at parties, because I ask all these terrible questions.
Are you being Socrates?
Oh, dude, I identify with the like, we want that guy to shut up. let's make him. Yeah. I think, I was a poli sci major, and so we covered a lot of philosophy stuffs back in the day, right? That's part of what informs how I approach a lot of the problem solving, is that these broader strategic social level things, right? Like, because you hope to get ahead of it, right? There, you know, the bit about, you know, you want to skate to where the puck's going to be, not where the puck is.
Yes.
Right? So this is the thing about jobs and tech and all this stuff, you know, it's like, where do you put your time? Your time is your one resource, right?
Right.
And so like, what do you put your time into? What do you invest it in?
I can only speak for myself. Like it goes back to the AI branding related activities. That's where I'm at. But that's also based on the analysis of where I'm at now, what will it take me to get to that next area. But for a college student, holy smokes, man, skating to where the puck is, there's no way to know that. Like even I don't know what AI is going to look like. I don't know what will be the hot thing in 4 years, 8 years. That's a tough one. But medical care is pretty solid. The robots are going to be a bit of a fly in the ointment at some point, but I think that's going to take some time. And robots, aren't good at everything. So,
well, there might be a calibration aspect where it's like, I'm going to go do medical. If I come out with 4 years at 200,000, but I'm expecting to get a job that pays 80 or 90 or 100, versus do I want to go to some place and come out with $400,000 of debt because I'm banking on I'm going to get a job that's going to pay 300. So you have to calibrate, I think, the thought process. Mm. Obviously, one of the problems about the portfolio on the skill set is to be competitive at the 400K level for the AI stuff, you're talking about master's and PhD level minimum in specialty things, right? So like right now it's vector database math based on machine learning stuff, but I could see to where it would be like, well, in 5 years, we feel like that aspect of it's sorted, and really it's the people that know how to bridge that with mechanical engineering for robotics that are the sweet spot. Oh, wait, now we're hiring a different kind of PhD that has both machine learning and electrical engineering like degrees or something. Like there was a kid I knew when in 1995, I was like on my way to Comdex and I'm on the bus and I'm this like young kid who thinks I'm pretty awesome because I got my first job working in the Bay Area. And there was a kid next to me that was making $100 on the bus. And I'm like, what do you do? And he's like, I write HTML for a bank in 1995. Oh. And he's like, I get paid $100 an hour. And I'm like, wow.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. But you know, getting paid $100 an hour to write HTML was a ephemeral thing. Right.
Right.
And that's what makes it so hard, because even the AI machine learning stuff, I couldn't tell you. Like, that's part of why it's like, well, I don't want to go get a PhD in machine learning because I don't know if it'll pan out in 7 years or whatever.
Well, maybe we're not practical people, Will. I mean, there's another type of work called business and MBAs, which is all about optimizing spend for profit. And that goes back into the more generic, ephemeral skill set that can be applicable to being a, I don't know, a manager at a company and how they're going to use AI or whatever the new thing is on the street. So it's a little bit more abstracted from that.
Well, and how much of that work is also just going to get wiped?
I don't know. Yeah. AI
that's where managers. We could spend hours just moving around. I mean, to a certain extent, if I have, if you take the more simple classic thing, which is you've got blue collar work and white collar work, right? That's like the one of the oldest simple classifications for work, blue collar, white collar. If AIs wipe out, if LLMs and AIs wipe out the white collar, and then we throw them all into robots that wipe out the blue collar. Right. Right. And that's why we spin. Because the problem is there's actually a quote from like a year ago that I saw somebody post online. They said, what would you be willing to bet me $100 that an AI or an LLM won't be able to do in 5 years?
It's just a foolish bet. Yeah. No, there's no reason to, I don't know who would, let me think about it. Can I actually, no, I just don't. It's just not, I can't think of anything I would take that bet on. Mm-hmm.
And this is why if you're an investor, right, do you want a chunk of that pie? That's why the big tech companies are all doing well in the market, because I think the premise is that you might wind up in this scenario where it's like, yeah, there's like 20 companies left.
Mm.
I saw a stat recently that said that we had 8,000 publicly traded companies like 10 years ago, and we're down to like 4,000.
Oh, really? Wow. So it's happening.
Yeah. Big consolidation.
What was peak company? When was that? About 70s?
No, it was about 2008.
Oh.
Part of what happened was that we had all these companies, and then when the 2008 crash happened and Sarbanes-Oxley came in, it put the reporting requirements for publicly traded companies, it made them really high. And so as companies have failed over the years, and, you know, COVID obviously wiped out a lot, what happened was those companies would just fail. And then that's where you've got private equity that would put money in, and you'd have companies that would get acquired, or in some cases even go private, you know, because the reporting requirements were high. And that's one of the challenges as you put in more and more requirements for reporting for public companies, then it becomes less and less to the point to be public. And then you have people who want to put money in public concentrating the money. That's one theory as to why the S&P 500 is doing so well and has been so resilient, is that there's just not really much else to do with your money at this point.
The metric you quoted was for public companies, right? So we don't know how many, we probably know how many private companies too, because they require business licenses. So I wonder if that number's, like, is it dark matter versus, you know, light lit matter type problem, where maybe there's a lot more private companies and they're just shifting to private, or is it just that there's less companies?
Well, so private companies, by definition, they don't need to report their financials. And so we might be able to collect business licenses data, but that doesn't tell you much. Like, for example, let's say that 50% of the private companies failed. Just as a, you know, market crash, we have no idea what the exposure looks like on that. So there are regulated entities like a lot of pension funds and stuff that they can't put their money into private, or they can only put a certain percentage in. So we hope that if there's a recession and a lot of these privates got scraped, that we wouldn't just get squished. Like when the 2008 crash happened, it was publicly traded companies and publicly traded insurance that was backstopping mortgage loans, right? And so when the 2008 crash happened, part of the reason why the government stepped in to stabilize the markets was because there were just so many people that had so much exposure, and then you're worried about the zipper effect. But right now we don't. Would the government step in to protect a market crash or a failure at the S&P 500 level versus would anybody step in if, say, a bunch of the big private equity firms imploded? Especially if you can't even participate in them unless you're an accredited investor. Like, so we could get a recession, and it's all, yeah, I think that your phrase, the dark matter phrase, is actually pretty, that's an apt, we don't know where they are. We don't know what they look like. Warren Buffett's on record. He doesn't put any money into private equity because he's like, they require that you put your money in and they give you no disclosures. So it could all be Ponzi's and you'd never know.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
On that cheery note.
Nigel Grande teaches you systems thinking through dramatic storytelling, such as Carter takes a job to improve a logistics company's adaptability, but efforts to scale agile practices are being blocked by Mr. Chernesky, a vice president who's organized the company into siloed pigeonholes in order to secretly make millions with a dark web shipping service. Carter's life is in danger. He goes underground, and a spy agency hunts for him. When Carter uses systems thinking, systems modeling, and organizational change to save his company and his life, you get to learn how to apply that to your organization as well. Get your free copy of Agile Grande at leanpub.com.
We've got more value in the show notes, which have useful links that we discussed or are related to this topic. What are show notes? Show notes show up right in your podcast player for your easy access. If you don't use a podcast player and you downloaded this MP3, go back to the website where you got it and you will see the show notes there. The series started at episode 309. If you're like my friend Boris and you missed the first episode or any of the intervening episodes, go to agilethoughts.info and there you'll find a search box where you can type in the episode number and it will find it for you in a jiffy. Next episode, more Will Iverson.
We have the tools and the tech to be able to do things like fix climate change. We have the tools and the tech and the capacity to get to where we could do amazing things with healthcare and energy and transportation and housing and all that kind of stuff. But the problem is us figuring out how to allocate it and manage it and cope with it. And also, how do you put food on the table in what is going to look like a deflationary period? It's going to be really weird.